So my name is Viktor Piotrowski. I'm a SATSI program officer and focusing mostly on the education perspective. And I would like to mention that the video that you just saw is one of the SATSI EDU projects funded a year ago. Before I introduce the panel, I would like just to remind everybody that SATSI has several perspectives, including education perspective, but this is not the only way we fund cybersecurity education. I would like to mention that there is another program at with the significant budget of $45 million a year. It's called CyberCore Scholarship for Service. And that program has two tracks. In a scholarship track, we award multi-million awards to schools to recruit students to cybersecurity programs. Students will receive excellent scholarship, probably even with a better benefits than graduate fellowship. And then in exchange of this, students need to work for the federal, state, local, or tribal government for as long as they receive that scholarship. The second track that usually a lot of people don't go beyond the title of the solicitation saying scholarship for service, so a lot of people don't realize that within that solicitation is also education, is also, sorry, capacity building track. That means the awards from, say, 300,000 to 900,000, depending on the scale and the size of the project, that increase the overall capacity of US higher education enterprise in cybersecurity. So with this short introduction about funding opportunities in cybersecurity education, let me introduce the panel. I have three distinguished colleagues here with me today. Starting left to me is Diana Burley from George Washington University. Then Zachary Peterson from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and Shriram Krishnamurti from Brown University. Our plan for this panel is to have a little introduction from each of the panelists with some kind of a statement, roughly about 10 minutes each, and then we'll move to more interactive session. We will welcome questions from you. I have some questions too, so we can mix your questions and our, but we want to spend significant amount of time interacting with you. So let's first go to the first part, and Diana, why don't you start?
Sure, thank you. So in that vein of getting you involved in answering questions or having you ask questions, I'm going to pose several questions to you from a couple of different perspectives related to education and cybersecurity. The first is this notion of educating everyone and thinking critically about how to spread cybersecurity across the curriculum. And when I say across the curriculum, I don't just mean in computer science, although we certainly have to think about how to get cybersecurity in the computer science at large curriculum, but across the curriculum, across the university. So how do we think about spreading cybersecurity principles, cybersecurity concepts into curricula in information systems, information science, economics, English, business, health, everything that you can think of within the university? Now, a couple of points related to spreading cybersecurity across the curriculum is, number one, this is a very complicated endeavor, and so I'm not going to give you answers, but I'm going to pose some questions to you, because as we start thinking about what it really means to spread cybersecurity across the curriculum, we have to think about audience. What is the background of these individuals? What will they be able to do? So when we're thinking about which cybersecurity principles to implement in these different parts of the curriculum, what is the context in which these students will go off and use cybersecurity knowledge? What role will they play in the workforce? All of these questions come to mind, and these are questions outside of the very basic questions that we all struggle with, which is, where do we put it? How do we find room? Do we think about this in terms of adding additional courses? Do we think about it in terms of adding modules to existing courses? How do these decisions relate to accreditation? and other decisions that we have to make about our curricula at large. It also brings to mind questions of diversity. How do we get more women and ethnic minorities involved in cybersecurity? Where do they sit in the curriculum as students? And so how can we begin to address some of these questions? It also brings questions related to faculty and faculty development. One of the things that we struggle with, even in cybersecurity programs, is how to maintain currency of faculty knowledge and skill set in a very rapidly evolving field. How do we maintain hands-on skills and those kinds of things? So it's one challenge when we're focused in cybersecurity programs. It becomes a completely different matter when we have to start thinking about faculty members who didn't have the knowledge to begin with. It's very apropos for a program like SATSE, where we're talking about collaboration and collaboration across curricula, across programs. And so it provides an opportunity for us to think about how to enact those collaborations in order to spread cybersecurity across the curriculum. The second point that I want to focus your attention on is on assessment and evaluation. We often hear about anecdotal or perhaps success stories that have occurred at different programs, whether they are through competitions, whether they are through some type of innovative practice within the classroom. When you start talking about scaling, we have to move away from anecdotal or individual or even school-wide successes and get to the point where we can address very real questions about how to scale these innovations, how to scale them at like institutions, how to scale them at different institutions. But how do we measure whether or not our curriculum or our curricular innovations are in fact effective? Again, this provides us an opportunity to engage in the type of collaborative activities that SATSE is really promoting, because there are individuals on campus who have expertise in assessing curricula. They usually sit on the faculties in your schools and colleges of education. Work with them, collaborate with them so that you can begin to really have some real assessments of whether and how and when and for whom your curricular innovations are working or not, so that you can begin to scale them and to move us forward. So with that, I will turn it over to my next panelist, but I'd like to leave you with those two things to consider.
Thank you. My name is Zachary Peterson. I'm an assistant, relatively new assistant professor at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and I'm really interested in the use of games and computer security education, and all kinds of games. So why games? Well, games have this inherent attraction, particularly to students who may not initially be attracted to computer science, either because they don't have the opportunities, they may not be able to afford the equipment, they may be too young to really engage fully what it means to be a computer scientist. So games are generally attractive. They can be very accessible to broad audiences as well. So they can engage students who have low computer literacy or low computer comfort, so those who kind of say computers are only for boys, let's say. So you might be able to attract or engage in computer science concepts to a broader audience. They can be inexpensive to deploy. One of my projects is a open source board game that you can either download and print on your own, or quite cheaply, for maybe about $25, get a professional printed copy of it. This is far cheaper than it would be to set up even a single computer in a classroom, and I mean, let alone the equipment costs, the maintenance costs, and trying to get 30 kids around a single computer. So games also have this magic ability to dispel any feeling of being trained. And so you're kind of educating them while they're not looking. They have no pretense of trying to represent some accurate simulation of real life. And so it allows you to engage in computer security or computer science concepts without actually even saying those words. They can be very social and lighthearted. And unfortunately, that's something this discipline misses the mark on sometimes. Let's say, comparison to isolating, overly constrained computer programming exercises, we can express personal preferences through role play or to create opportunities for near-peer learning. They can also be really effective in communicating core computer security concepts. For broad computer security concepts. So for example, just generating that computer security mindset, thinking analytically, even just interpreting the rules amongst each other or individually requires thinking analytically, counterfactual thinking, like what happens if I do this? And then again, role playing. This is such a valuable skill to put yourself in the mind of an attacker, the mind of a user. And then to really reflect the creative and social aspects of security, which oftentimes constrained programming assignments, or even some of the full scale computer security competitions have trouble capturing sometimes. So my interests have manifested themselves recently in three big efforts. I mentioned one. It's called Doxed. It's spelled ZD0X3D, LeetSpeak. Doxing is the idea of getting your personal information posted online for everyone to see. So your goal is to not have that happen. And it is a open source board game. I will have a copy with me at the poster session if you want to come by and see it. It's very accessible. I've used it in summer camps with, I would say, fourth and fifth graders is kind of about the lower bound, up through under division, lower division classes at Cal Poly. It has very modest pedagogical goals. It's to introduce terminology, to create a catalyst for discussing concepts of computer security. In fact, on the Doxed website, d0x3d.com, you can download three curriculum modules that we built that you can use in particularly any classroom. And so things about ethics and hacking, or one of the characters that you play is a social engineer. So we discuss what is social engineering and how do you leverage psychological aspects to get what you want digitally. So that's one. A more recent effort is in the use of alternate reality games in the classroom. So to create this immersive experience where students play themselves notionally in a game that has thematically related puzzles. And so we most recently did this to our incoming freshmen. So Cal Poly, like Harvey Mudd, like I think CMU, like Berkeley, has this new Welcome to CS class that is not your intro to programming class, which has been shown to have some really negative effects throughout with retention, particularly in underrepresented populations. And so we present computer scientists through some creative, socially relevant lens that students may already be familiar with. So it comes in a variety of flavors, music, art, and I teach one on security. And the way that I taught it was essentially like a quarter-long capture the flag game where the students broke into teams and they played against me essentially with a narrative that I was doing something more nefarious than I was supposed to be, and that the students knew it was a game. So we tried hard not to make them feel like their grades were in danger or that something serious was going to happen. But at the same time, balancing that with this is not a game philosophy that ARGs tend to adhere to. So why ARGs? So there's actually, outside of computer science, there's been a really interesting critical look at the use of ARGs in pedagogy. And they're shown to address a lot of the issues that we actually have in computer science, things like maintaining engagement, like providing social relevance to what you're doing. So for example, if you have a puzzle piece that exists as part of a tweet or as part of a comment on Reddit or as part of a YouTube video, students are much more likely to engage or at least be familiar with those technologies, and they kind of start to see how the pieces all fit together. Again, social, build community, and track this kind of recent other movement in what's called process-oriented guided inquiry learning, which is essentially the professor steps back and provides some initial guidance, but provides some to a group where the groups have individual roles. So I'm going to be the archivist. I'm going to take all the notes, or I'm going to be the communicator and I'm going to communicate with the other groups, or I'm going to be the researcher and I'm going to go. And so you give students a problem and then they independently go and research that and try to solve the problems on their own with only occasional guidance from the faculty member. And what this has been shown to have is students that make the discoveries themselves, the information is better retained and improved and has improved conceptual understanding more long term. The last thing I want to talk about, and I'll make it brief because I know I'm kind of going on here, is a workshop that I've helped organize called 3GSE, Games, Gamification, and maybe Games Again, in Security Education. Maybe I should create an acronym I can remember. It is a USENIX-sponsored workshop. It was held for the first time last year, co-located with USENIX Security. It'll be happening again this year in this town in August. And it brings together those who have any interest in games and gaming in computer science or computer security education. So whether it's through capture the flag exercises, through kind of training modules, through non-digital games, things just to for outreach. We are very, very interested in your participation. If you are in this audience, maybe you have some interest in that. So feel free to Google that and or come find me later.
Thanks, Zach. I want to transition from something very sexy, which is games, to something very unsexy. I'm also going to ask you questions, and I'm going to expect you to vote on the answers. So since I know some of you by name, you're going to have to stop reading email, because otherwise I might call on you in person. And I see some people smiling a little guiltily. OK, so let's start with the first question. How many of you think code review is actually a valuable thing to do? Code review, raise your hands. OK, very good. That was easy, easier than I thought. OK, how many of you think code review and security is a useful, a valuable thing to do? Hopefully, even more hands have gone up. Very good. All right. So those of you who are instructors at universities, how many of you code review your students' work? And how many of you have your students code review each other? 2, 3, 4, 5 hands. Okay, so I just want you to notice the difference between those two numbers and ponder that for a moment. I want to talk a little bit about this code review business because I think it's something that we've neglected a lot, but it's not just code that deserves reviewing. There are a lot of things that students produce that deserve reviewing, and some people who do HCI classes, for example, I assume at least some of the people whose hands went up do HCI-style classes, and what you do there is you do design crits, right? You do crits of the user interface design and various other designs, and I think we should be thinking about this more broadly. If you think about two of the most high-profile security violations that have been found this year, you know that they came about because somebody actually sat down and read the code, right? So while we're waiting for our wonderful static analyses to catch up with human beings, it's still a useful skill to be teaching one another. Now, there's two particular takes that I want to give on code reviewing and reviewing in general. One of them is there's been some amount of work that's been done on review, and it tends to be of the following form. You do an assignment, you turn it in, and then you do reviewing. Make sense? No, it doesn't make any sense. Because what's anyone going to do with the feedback? Right? Students have moved on to doing something else. And in fact, most of them don't care. And the few who do are going to be frustrated because they don't have any time to do anything with the feedback. So we've been trying to study, we're doing various user studies of how it works to do the review process while an assignment is still in progress. Now, what's the obvious problem with doing reviews while an assignment is in progress? Come on. The P word, or somebody used the C word. Plagiarism, copying, right? So this is state-sanctioned plagiarism, basically, right? I think this is actually a good way to think about this. Because if you think about the way people are evolving and the way a lot of software construction is evolving, more and more the problem is less of constructing code from scratch, and more it's being able to make an intelligent evaluation of something that you find, either in an open source repository or an answer on Stack Overflow or in a blog post or something else, and taking that and bringing that into part of your solution. So this is the general space of stuff we've been studying. This relates very well to things that Zach talked about having peers working with one another. One of the things that this does is also, it gives the sense that maybe computer science is not such a hermetical discipline after all, but maybe you actually do communicate with one another, maybe you do work interactively, collaboratively, even when it is finally your own work that's being evaluated individually. So a lot of work we've been doing on code review. Not much of it is focused on security so far, though we are starting up a great big new project with some people who are in the audience on trying to do this across a variety of security classes, peer review of all kinds of things, of essays, of programs, of tests, of designs, and so on, across a variety of security classes. So I don't have much to say about security specifically, but I think there's enough hands in the room that believe this is a thing worth doing, so we'll do it and let you know how it works out. So that's all I wanted to say in terms of a position piece, and now we should hopefully have questions from the audience.
We have a question from the audience. Oh, we have somebody leaving, one of the two.
Okay. When we are waiting for the question for the audience, let me start with the first question. I wanted to ask either you or the panelists, what do you mean reading the title of this session? You know, how you understand this? The title of this panel is Educating Everyone, right? Mm-hmm. What does it mean?
I'm not going to give you an answer, but I'll at least start the discussion. And I'll tie it back to a study that we did. I co-chaired last year for the National Academies that looked at the question of professionalization of the cybersecurity workforce. And our big struggle really throughout, but certainly at the onset, was to define the cybersecurity workforce. And some people on our committee defined it as everyone, being those people who were very technically oriented, but also business owners and healthcare workers and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so for us and for that study, we took a broad approach and said everyone truly is everyone who is in the workforce, and what we have to do is then to unbundle that and to structure that and to say, okay, now we need to think about specifically for these different parts of the workforce, how do we begin to determine what education needs to happen and in what way?
I think there's been an acknowledgement as manifested in some curricular changes that computer science more broadly is important for everyone. So if you look at Harvey Mudd, I think they make all of their students take CS1. Computer security is probably even more important, or at least has more of a prerequisite for seeing it early. Because when we push computer security to a late term elective, it means students have already solidified their programming habits. It means they've already mostly solidified their design and mindsets. So by making security, at least is this what I've been pushing my department chair for, by making security a first year, first quarter initiative, that this is giving them maximum runway for exploring and practicing computer security practices throughout their collegiate career and hopefully into their professional career. Even if it is just a modest, I recognize there are security problems out there, that would create a fundamental shift, I think, as Latanya said this morning, right? The students who just have that ability to see where the problems might be, right, have extreme value to their organizations.
I can't improve on those two answers.
Well, I see Carl Landwehr sitting here, and he had that wonderful project, and I think he was teaching this recently, right? The cybersecurity for presidents? Oh, still in progress. Cybersecurity for everyone. But now let's go to the question, the first question.
So I had a question about scalability and assessment, and it's rather controversial question, which I hopefully we embrace here. I've been teaching for many, many years. I don't think that assessment, formal assessment, has really much influence over how I teach a course. In other words, if I saw a paper that said, students understand this better if you do X or Y, my first instinct is to be suspicious because I don't really understand the tools in the educational community, and I don't understand how I can value them. Would it not maybe be more practical, to adopt an entrepreneurial mindset where you take interesting ideas and make them widely known and, teachers, educators can pick out what seems to them to be appropriate?
Well, I am certainly not going to discourage an entrepreneurial mindset. Okay, I think it's important for us to do trial and error and to understand what works for us as educators and what works for our students as individuals and as collectives. That being said, while you or many of us, frankly, don't necessarily understand the nuances of how to develop learning assessments and how to understand how students learn, there is an entire field of people who do. And so I am not advocating that we begin to try to take that on. What I am advocating is that we collaborate with the individuals who investigate learning as a science, because they do have that expertise, and to come together to begin to make some decisions that are based on scientific evidence of learning and whatever the measure is that we're trying to achieve with our particular learning activities, so that we can move the ball forward in a way that balances an entrepreneurial spirit with an ability to make some real decisions based on scientific evidence of what seems to work for different populations and different skills and et cetera.
But if I may push the issue further.
Sure.
I am deeply suspicious of an attempt to use science in the interests of education because it has failed so miserably over the last 50 years. And I wonder if this really will result in a betterment of computer science education.
Well, I won't take on the banner of whether learning science is, because I'm not a learning science person. So I can't advocate for something that I'm not an expert in. But I will say that just because it's not perfect or we haven't seen perfect results doesn't mean that there's not a scientific basis and that there aren't some things that we could learn and understand how to do better. And particularly when we are in an environment where we need to scale, where we need to have a workforce, all aspects of the workforce from the highly technical to the non, and we need, many, many more than what we have. What we don't want to do is have efforts that don't produce what we think we need to produce. And I point to, when we talk to employers, industry, government, et cetera, and they say, I've come to recruit and I have these people and I've taken these people into my organization, and even though the degree says this and even though the course titles say this, and even though the list of items that they were taught in the course said this, when I get them into my organization, they can't do any of those things. And so what I'm saying is that we need to be much more purposeful in understanding how to develop particular types of skills, particular types of knowledge with particular types of students, recognizing that there are people who learn differently, such that we can make more informed choices. Is it a perfect situation? No.
Right. So Shira, you want to?
I would like to respond to this in two very different ways. So first of all, I've heard this kind of response. So you wanted controversy. I'll give you controversy. Okay. This kind of response is the classic symptom of laziness. Okay. I did 20 years of educational outreach, you know, NSF-funded educational outreach. And typical response communication went something like this. We've got this curriculum with a lot of evaluation, works really well. Well, that works at Brown's. That might work for you hoity-toity people. It's not going to work for us. What also works WPI? Well, WPI is also a private school. What also works University of Delaware? Yeah, but that's on the East Coast. What's also being used at Cal Poly? Yeah, but that's only on the two coasts. What about the Midwest? People can play this game to infinity, and it's a lot easier to play this game than to sit down and read the damn paper and try to make sense out of it. Okay, now, that said, I've also tried to reach educational literature and psych literature, and my brain is not large enough for it. Okay, in fact, I had to get this guy here, the most interestingly dressed person in the room today, Serge Egelman, to help me like figure out how to read this kind of literature in the first place. Okay, so I agree, it's really hard. I'm going to suggest a name, Richard Felder, F-E-L-D-E-R. So for the, you seem to know who he is. For those of you who don't, Richard Felder is a chemical engineer at the University of North Carolina State, who basically, you know, had a successful career as a researcher and then said, you know, there's an awful lot about education that education people seem to know that I don't know. I was thrown into a classroom just like many of the rest of us here. So I'm going to actually lay down my life for my community. I'm going to sit down, read this literature, and try to make it readable to a person who is trained like me, i.e. not trained in social sciences. Okay? And I found, so Felder talks a lot about learning styles, which is a controversial topic, but it was hugely insightful for me to read his work, and it dramatically improved the way I teach. So I would say that there is a communication problem, you're right, and sometimes a person like Felder, who I encourage people to go look up, Richard Felder, people like him, well, and I'm not sponsored by him, but people like him do take the trouble of making that entire body of literature somewhat distilled and accessible. But at the end of the day, if you take yourself seriously, you got to sit down and read the damn stuff, man.
Let me follow two quick points. One is, I think a lot of these problems are a manifestation of not having common metrics or common tools that we all use. I was, as part of my investigation, went back into the literature all the way back to 1984. I was six at the time. Lloyd and Gossard had this thing called the Computer Attitude Survey, and they were trying to measure exactly what we're trying to measure now, and it was validated, and it was used 20, 30 times, and then it disappeared. And so we're trying to use it again. And our results are a little bit different than theirs, and so maybe that's interesting, maybe we're not using it right. But so I think there's a huge value to us all getting on the same page, at least being able to speak the same language when it comes to talking about metrics and evaluation. The other thing I would suggest, take a walk down to your school of education, right? These are people who care passionately about this stuff and have a wide variety of tools. I was interested in doing group learning, and my evaluator said, look at this POGL paper. And it is exactly, and we can, you know, draw from other disciplines. Chemistry, out of chemistry is where POGL came. There's the physics and concept inventory. Why don't we have a concept inventory for computer security? You know, there's lots of things we could do to catch up with the other sciences in terms of learning.
Well, thank you very much for the question. It was definitely an interesting discussion. We have another question.
Name is Chao Wang from UNC Charlotte. I want to first answer Victor's earlier question and lead to my own question. So when I see the panel name of Educating Everyone, I immediately thinking about the all the interdisciplinary field. Actually, if you look at smart or intelligent manufacturing, smart grid, you can see the documents showing that there are tens of thousands of opening positions to be filled for future workforce with the basic information tech security knowledge. That's what I was thinking when I see the panel's title. And this actually lead to my own question, because I have the opportunity to work with smart grid people and also intelligent manufacturing people. So we are trying to develop course modules and educational materials for these students in these fields, and we also work with community colleges. So one major hurdle that we are facing is when you try to step into these fields, such as manufacturing or smart grid, they demand a lot of knowledge in their field. So you have a very tough or very steep learning curve to understand their language and their, so basically what they are facing and what they're talking about. So I want to ask what the panelists think. Is there some way to overcome this hurdle or better understand their language or to learn their expertise so that we can better serve their needs?
So it's an easy, snappy comeback, which is not very helpful, which is how much are they willing to pay for it? Because my guess is they want to pay the same thing that they pay. They don't want to spend nearly enough, invest nearly enough in the educational process, but would still like these wonderful unicorn people who know all about grids and all about security. Is that right?
It's a little bit, how to say that? From my point of view, I think security education should become something similar to fire safety. Okay, currently our model is like, okay, we have the expertise in manufacturing, and then we hire a few people who know security, so we deal with a manufacturing problem, you deal with any security problem. That is quite different from fire safety. You don't burn your house or do whatever you want to do because there are firefighters available, right? We teach the very young kids that, hey dude, when you see smoke, stop, lay down in a row, right? We should adopt some models similar to that. We need to embed secure education to those engineering majors when they first enroll in their courses. That's what I think. But
well, if I can insert a quick reply to this, looking, for example, at computer science curriculum, that one of the popular recommendations is ACM curricular recommendations published every 10 years, starting from, I think, early 70s. So every 10 years, we look around and say, oh, we completely forgot about networking 10 years ago, so let's add networking. Or the recent ones, we completely forget about cybersecurity up to this point. Let's insert some cybersecurity. But we don't drop anything. So that means since those 1970s, we were adding, and you physically don't have more hours to add. And I founded some project that tried to reach to faculty across CS curriculum and failed to recruit faculty to try some modules or insert because everybody is so overloaded with content. Yeah. So I see this as a major problem that we keep adding and we hesitate to drop anything. You know, whatever was a classic in 60s is still there.
Let me just add one thing to that, and this is something that comes up quite often, is some of the things that you were talking about were not, stop, drop, and roll, and those kinds of things are fundamental foundational concepts that we as individuals learn along the way. Mm-hmm. What we have to be careful of is that we don't try to say, well, you know what, since we didn't get any of that, since the kids who are now 20 didn't get any of that with regard to cybersecurity when they were 5, 7, 10, we're now gonna put it all into a freshman year of an undergraduate educational program. Doesn't work like that. And so that's one of, and I hate to even bring it up, but one of the things that I always push back against when we talk about cybersecurity education and we go to analogies like medicine, is that we forget that medical doctors or students who are in medical school have gone through 4 years of undergraduate school first, and they've gone through high school and all those things first, and so we have to be very careful about recognizing what is appropriate for putting into an undergraduate curriculum and what is appropriate for putting in a K-12 curriculum or something that's related to cybersecurity awareness or what have you. Recognizing that we have to catch up and you know that we have progress that we need to make, but also being mindful of the fact that we can't just say, well, they don't have it, so we're going to load it all into freshman year, because it's just not going to happen.
Okay,
I want to say one thing. It may be kind of ancillary, which is there's a culture in computer science that can be a little, maybe some of the problems are due to communication skills. And the walls are not just put in place procedurally, organizationally, they're put in place by the individuals. I am the computer security guy, that's what I do. And so in computer science, we tend to develop and reinforce that, you know, you must be the fastest, you must be the best programmer with the best response times. We enforce this in industry by practices like firing the bottom 5% of your company every year I was having a conversation. What is the average age of a programmer now? It's got to be getting to the age where they have families, right, and other responsibilities where they don't want to put in the 8-hour work week and are willing to cut back on exceptionalism to be competent and to be a valuable member. So I think there are some cultural things we can do inside of education that might help these kind of social issues inside a diverse organization.
Thank you.
Okay, I think somebody's walking to the microphone.
So we talk a lot about trying to get security earlier in the education process, and I fully believe that that's an excellent goal. But part of the problem we have, particularly with women and minorities and other groups coming into these programs, is they don't come in with a technical background. They're learning them right then. And one of the struggles I continuously run into is that you need a certain amount of knowledge of computer science before you start understanding these complexities involved with computer security. Now, there are a lot of things you can teach. So, for instance, I teach a class on privacy that you can talk a lot about these concepts at a high level, but I struggle with students who do not understand that web pages come together from multiple places. Forget trying to, you know, go into the complexities of Kerberos. So, how do you balance that, like trying to put something early before the students understand it versus late when they don't have a chance to follow up on it?
I would say two things. One is absolutely. The greatest challenge of teaching my freshmen was in the differential of experience. So we had some students who were coming in with computer science AP credit. They were more than competent programmers, certainly more than I was at that age, to students who had almost, I would say, low computer confidence, even familiarity with the computer. And that's fine. Like, we welcomed that. The question was, what do we do? We learned pretty quickly that by putting them in teams and having them capture flags as a team was a terrible idea, because what it meant was is that those who had experience went off and captured all the flags, and those who didn't just kind of languished a little bit. So now we changed it so that every student needs to capture their own flags with helps of their teams. So there's again, I'll point to this POGL method as ways to deal with differences in expertise. Programmatically or curriculum-wise, there are ways to teach computer science generally through concepts of security that I think can be very effective. UCLA recently had a SIGC paper on doing just this. They taught intro to programming by teaching essentially a quarter-long implementation of the login program. And one of their goals was not to punish making mistakes or to when you made, let's say, an order of operation misunderstanding or how a logical operator works. Those things were given extra points, like, look, you found this mistake. That's really important. Or here's how order of operations work, and here's how they can be abused. So in my class, we did a very, very simple integer overflow thing. Those are you know, really powerful and commonplace bugs that can be taught at, I think, at a very simple level. There are larger ideas, things like amplification hardness. What makes a password difficult to choose? Well, have them break passwords in a really simple way. At the same time, you can teach them about loops and conditionals. So I think there is a growing body of how to build curriculum through the computer science curriculum through this lens of security that I think could be really successful.
Can I also this point to, so this is a really great question, by the way, and there's a dichotomy here, right? There's what you can teach people about protecting themselves versus what you teach them as technologists who are therefore responsible for protecting a large number of people, right? You can teach somebody very early on about things, you know, various sorts of social attacks and so on, which you can do it through the guise of protecting themselves, which are actually, I mean, I think the biggest problem with getting them thinking about security is getting them to think in the security mindset. Right? There's this logical machine, and then there's this great big physical space in which making phone calls can break the machine, because you can make phone calls and call them up 10 times and eventually get the first digit of a social security number, and do that again to get the second digit of the social security number. This is completely outside the sort of this logical box that we're used to thinking about, right? This is entirely in that physical space. But doing that education could be done pretty early. That requires very little, in fact, a lot of it has nothing to do with computer science, in fact, right? But doing that early on, I think, is good for getting people thinking about the ways in which systems work in unanticipated ways, which I think is the heart of the problem,
right? And then, of course, you have to know enough about the system to understand what the anticipated ways are, and that becomes a later problem. But I think you can think of this in two different ways and do one as a guise of, like, personal education, which everyone on a campus should probably have. And then the other one is, okay, now you've built your first web application, now we're going to tell you all the dumb things that you did, right? So maybe it's useful to think about that dichotomy.
I would just, let me just add one other thing, and this is outside of thinking specifically about security, but we're not the only ones to face this challenge. This is a STEM challenge. Let's talk to the other people on campus who are also facing this issue, but not necessarily with regard to computer science. They might be facing it because they were trying to get people in their math classes or their biology or et cetera, and collaborate across the disciplines to determine what techniques, what methods, what instructional methods worked or are working, and then begin to implement them, assessing them, of course, right, to make sure that they really will work for us. But we have to get out of a mindset of thinking that we're all alone and we're the only ones that are facing this challenge, because this is a larger STEM challenge that the country is facing. And there have been some significant steps forward in understanding how to get students the background that they need to have.
Actually, one quick comment related to that. I think there's a broader issue here which relates a little bit to, you know, so Zach was talking about all these great curricula, but, you know, how do you bring security into an early curriculum? But the point is, you talk to machine learning people and they think you should be learning machine learning in your first course. And you talk to the networking people, like, how can you live in today's world without knowing about networks, right? I mean, so everybody's got their own view about how this stuff should be done. So that's really the issue, is no one of these curricula is going to satisfy any of them, and we just happen to be the special security snowflakes here. That's all.
Yeah, but we're so, right.
That's yeah, the that's okay. The difference. That's
okay, let's move that to the next question.
Hi, Sanjay Goyal, SUNY Albany. I have two questions, actually, and maybe one of them is a comment. First, I'll follow up on Victor's statement that the computer science education is just growing and growing and growing with different components. Same thing is happening with security education. We started with a very limited scope of security education, but over time, we have cyber physical systems, we have chip security, we have security phishing, everything that you can talk of. The cybersecurity curriculum just grows and grows and grows. At some point, do we need to start differentiating between the types of security experts that we create? The second question is about the quality of education. If you are doing cybersecurity education, good quality, that's very expensive. We have tried a lot of innovations. We have done the teaching hospital. We have done the flipped classroom. We are doing the online flipped classroom, and they work great. But each of them takes a lot of investment. And what we are seeing is that the obsolescence rate is very high. We develop something, and while we are developing it, it's already obsolete. So the question is, unless we amortize what we develop over a large audience, it's going to get obsolete very, very quickly. And so how do you keep putting investments into this when developing good security curriculum is that expensive? Talk about games, talk about flipped classrooms, they are all expensive to make. So how does the community deal with this?
Maybe I don't have an answer, but I'll actually add one more problem, is that there's no 2 days in security that look the same, right? I mean, you just kind of look at the last year, 10 years, right? And I don't know, that a fundamental, let's say a Newtonian physics class, or let's say an intro to calculus class, which might look pretty much the same across many major universities, I don't think the intro to security course looks the same. And I think it's really predicated on the individual interests. What is the core? What are the foundations of computer security? I'm sure there's some overlap, but do we still teach MLS systems? I know we did at my previous institution. Do they still have the same value as understanding crypto, right? Even our understandings of crypto have changed, right? That you can't have confidentiality without integrity anymore. Those things used to be separable, right? Now they're not.
If I cannot, to some extent, cybersecurity wants to find its own identity. You know, the question, is this a science, right? There is the entire movement, science of cybersecurity, right? Are there some fundamental foundations, you know, that we need to discover?
That's certainly one thing. I mean, there are a lot of folks that are looking at this question of, is there a science of cybersecurity that we can identify those fundamental principles that need to be taught across all cybersecurity programs? But I'm going to point you to how you started off with your comment about not just is computer science growing, but cybersecurity is growing. And perhaps it becomes a question of specialization. And and recognizing that because it's growing, you can't have programs that necessarily meet all needs, that you have to specialize, and that you specialize with regard to your employers, the folks that are around you industry-wise, because they are interested in making investments in academic programs to maintain a workforce that will meet their needs. And so one approach is to begin to think about specialization tied to wherever, whether it's your community or your region or whatever it is, where your employers might be interested in working with you to invest in the development and maintaining the currency of the academic programs.
Yeah, I would argue actually that's almost certainly happening at every one of our institutions already, mm-hmm. right? I look at what we do. We, you know, Brown Produce's students are great for doing web security for, you know, dot coms. I imagine our students, if they went to government, would probably struggle. If they went to work for a smart grid or smart manufacturing company, they would be completely lost. I would like to think we've taught them some principles. And this relates to your comment about this sort of rapidly moving frontier. I shouldn't generalize too much, but too many of the courses I've seen and the books I've seen spend an awful lot of energy about breaking stuff and not enough about making stuff well. So obviously things keep changing and new attacks keep coming on the horizon, but I think the more you focus on stuff brokenness, the harder it is going to be to stay current because there's whole new levels of brokenness every day.
Right. I think one of the questions which I'm trying to tend to is there a core curriculum which can stay fairly static? And then we can go beyond that. I think that's something as a community we need to think through. What is that core curriculum which we need to teach us? Exactly the point which I'm trying to raise,
yep.
is that it's changing so rapidly, so fast, we need to basically abstract it into a core curriculum which is fairly static. Because see, the investment is not coming from the company. The investment is coming on the faculty who are actually teaching these courses. Compare two different faculty, one teaching standard networking and the other security. The security person has to revamp the curriculum each and every year, new labs, new everything else.
Right.
So I think
I think that the folks that are working on the science of security are doing exactly that. They're trying to identify those core principles, that core curriculum that could remain, at least in some sense, static enough, or maybe stable enough. Now, I won't say static, but perhaps stable enough that you can have some level of comfort in that. But it's in progress.
So right. Two quick comments. One is I think we do have many, many principles we could articulate. I suspect if we sat down in this room, we'd find that there's a good chunk of principles we can articulate, and I'm sure you can name several of them yourself. But here's another experiment I did. Some of my training is in programming languages, and programming languages people love to complain about how, you know, these damn people who build scripting languages, if they would just listen to us, things would be so much better, which I think is true. But, so I've done this at conferences. I go around, find PL people, like some of my esteemed friends sitting in this room, and I say, okay, name five principles you think that everyone ought to know, that are sort of self-evident that every, you know, language designer ought to know. And you'd be shocked by how little agreement there is there too, right? So, you know, it turns out that everybody's got five principles, they just happen to not correspond to anybody else's five principles. So I think it may just be that the problem is much more visible because of the rapid change right now in security, but the same problem is actually true in most of our other disciplines. It's just not as urgent and just not as evident, that's all.
Well, that is true. A lot of emerging disciplines have the same problem.
Yeah.
Rapid obsolescence, you know, but cybersecurity is so widespread,
it
is so well recognized.
In a particularly bad way, yeah.
It'll be worth thinking about it as we go forward.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Before we go to the next question, let me plug in one website and one initiative that some of you might not know about. The acronym is NICE, N-I-C-E. The acronym stands for National Initiative for Cybersecurity Education that started in April 2010. And one of the more interesting products of NICE is something what is called Workforce Framework, in which we try to look at the modern taxonomy, or looking from the workforce point of view, especially, you know, mostly federal government, but we look nationally. And if you look at OPM of Department of Labor, they still, everybody working in security will be classified as information processing specialist or something like, you know, 1980s terminologies. So that NICE created a framework that defined 7 roles and 32 kind of like top level areas that people working, workforce, people working in security work. It might be investigation,
or operations and so on. So if you look at that nice framework, the next step is you drill a little bit down, and we used a lot of experts over a period of 2 years to identify knowledge, skills, and abilities needed to perform those tasks. And you can go drill down, and somehow you can customize your course if you have in mind what will be the role. Mm-hmm. And obviously, it's, you know, the lower level of education, the easier it is. Like that where community colleges love this because it perfectly fits their model. In liberal arts environment, it's not that easy. But nevertheless, I encourage you to look at the nice framework.
Thank you.
Next question.
I'm actually following on to that last discussion on education. I just want to say something I think that's pretty obvious, we also right now have the tools to collaborate really effectively with our peers on teaching materials. And this is certainly something that I do all the time, not when it comes to teaching security classes, but when it comes to teaching programming languages classes. I borrow material and assignments from many, many colleagues that I have, and they're almost always extremely happy to give me those materials. And I know that it makes my courses 100 billion times better when I borrow everyone else's assignments, and then maybe I focus, you know, on adding one little bit myself. I would say that if people in this room don't have collaborators that they can borrow from, then this is a great opportunity to go up and talk to the people around, ask, you know, how are you teaching? Do you have any online materials that I can borrow? And to start to generate some networks, some faculty networks and faculty groups in order to get the materials that you need and help each other out. Many hands make light work, as they say. And I guess the second point that I would make is I don't believe in having one core curriculum for the entire world. I don't think that we'll ever agree. I'm not going to agree with Sriram on what we teach on programming languages. He's not going to, at least not on everything. On some things, yes. But anyway, so I wouldn't go for one global solution. I would go to try to generate little networks of friends and start by doing that right here.
Okay, so that was a comment rather than question.
Yes. Okay.
So I tend to agree that the science is the way to go about deciding what's going to be long-lived. And certainly I'm part of a very large project that does that. But I'm really curious, we should really be distinguishing between science and engineering. Most of the things we teach in security is engineering. Fix this, fix that, put a finger in those holes and it'll hold for a while. In fact, the question is, we have had the list of top most dangerous, 25 most dangerous security problems now for probably good 10, 15 years, longer maybe. Yet we are still making them all the time in all the software. That if you look at the latest set of problems, they all fall into that category. So are we not teaching at all, just ignoring it? Or are we not teaching the right stuff? But it's very difficult for me to understand why we are not teaching some of the basic things like wash your hands type of thing. Can you comment on that, please?
What makes you think that the average developer was taught by any of us? I mean, I'm serious.
There are millions
of developers out there. And in fact, it is not true. So I agree with you that it's frustrating how little movement we have on some of these problems. But we do have movement on some of these problems. Things have changed. The list that was there 15 years ago is not the same as the list that's there today.
People have
realized, oh my goodness, maybe type safety is not such a bad thing after all. And being, you know, Yahoo, Wild West programmers, maybe we should tone it down a little bit, right? We have actually made a little bit of progress on these things. Frameworks have come along and finally made like some of the stupidest some errors, right, go away automatically. So when people use Ruby on Rails or Django or whatever, much as you might hold your nose against them, at least they've made some problems go away. So I think we do have, part of the difficulty is reaching millions of developers. Right? The web is the best and the worst thing to have happened to us. It's the worst thing because, you know, everybody's a developer now and none of them are trained. And it's the best thing because what other discipline can you do that in, right? A high school student can build a bridge. They can build a little rocket, but they can't build like, you know, a Saturn V. But they can do these things. It's the blessing and curse of this discipline that we're in.
I think we should embrace it. It's great. Of course, we have to figure out how to provide better tools to them. But education's, I don't know, education's a little overrated, maybe. I didn't say that, did I? Okay. Oops, sorry. It's just that how much impact can we have sitting here, right?
Well, I think there's a distinction between formal education and informal education as well. And so, all of what we've been focusing on today has been formal education. But I think, too, especially given the point that we have developers who aren't necessarily going into the buildings where we're teaching the things that we think that they ought to know, we ought to think about how to get this information, this education out in informal ways that ensures that everybody is moving forward as well, whether they're coming into our classrooms or not.
Right. Well, so the follow-up on that is, if somebody gives you a shot, a flu shot, they better have a piece of paper that says that they can do that, right? Or they are breaking the law. Today, what you are telling me is that everybody can develop your car software and put all sorts of holes in it without any kind of certificate or piece of paper that says they understand security, they understand software engineering, or forget about the programming languages. Mm-hmm. So maybe we are discussing the wrong thing here. Shouldn't we perhaps take some of the well-known facts about security, about some of the other things, and actually try to develop certificates and certifications for people, rather than just hope they're going to learn by osmosis?
Well, there are certificates and certifications for people. What I think you're talking about is a license. And whether or not licenses are given to software developers to be a licensed software developer or what have you is something that has to emerge from the field, and then there have to be specific criteria that go along with holding and maintaining that license. And if that is something that you or anybody else believes ought to happen, then that's a discussion. And in fact, it is a discussion that is currently being had. But I invite you to join that discussion because that is, there are many different factors that go into whether or not someone should be licensed to do something, and licensed by whom, and licensed in what environment, state, federal, et cetera. So, but it's it is certainly a discussion that is being had across the federal government for sure.
So for years I used to go to software engineering conferences, and this is you can imagine what a hot topic this is at software engineering conferences. And basically there were two schools of view, roughly. There was, you know, the American school of view that said, licensing, give me a break, right? And the British school of view which said, we already do that, what's so wrong with that? So I think this may also come down to a significantly cultural conception, because there are certainly countries in the world where it seems completely obvious that stuff like this should be licensed, and licensing is already happening, and this is a solved question. There's nothing to even debate. And there are other countries where licensing is just never going to keep up with this sort of thing, and regulation's never going to work, and so it's a solved question. What's there to debate? And we just happen to be on the side of the pond.
Just as one aside, I would encourage you to take a look at our National Academy study, Professionalizing the Nation's Cybersecurity Workforce, because in that study, which came out last year, 2 years, September 2013, but in that study, we investigate all of these questions of professionalization, licensure, certifications, formal education across all aspects of the workforce. And so if you're interested in that debate, or at least understanding the criteria for making those decisions, it's in that report.
And spoiler alert, the conclusion of that report was that it's too early, that cybersecurity is not...
No, they won't download it. Yes.
That's what it says. That's what it says.
Okay, next question, please.
So the welcome Jim gave this morning, he talked about how the vast majority of the funding size has goes to research. And Victor may know the actual percentages, but the question I have, which hopefully is somewhat controversial, is if that fraction that's going towards education, which is a very small percentage now, should that be dramatically increased, assuming we can't just grow the whole budget and give everyone all the money they want, which we'd probably all be happy with. But if it's coming out of the research budget from SACHI, do you think the fraction that goes to education should be dramatically increased? And if it is, what would come out of that?
That's right.
Okay, so repeat
well,
one more time, because I'm kind of a little lost.
I guess I'm asking you if you want more money, but I'm asking the panelists if they want.
So what are you saying when you apply for a research?
They would like the education part, you know, the amount of funding that the NSF devotes to education in SATC particularly, to increase dramatically at the expense of research funding.
Oh, well okay. The official number that you will find on NSF budget website, it will show you that in last fiscal year, SATC budget that combines, just the SATC program and CyberCore program and other investment across the agency, SATC goes through the entire agency, was, I might be wrong a little with those numbers, but let's say about $112 million. Out of this 45, what is significant percentage was devoted to education. 45 out of 112. Okay. So it's a little bit more than one third.
So maybe you can say whether it should be less.
That was CyberCore though, right?
But let me add one more comment. The one thing that we've been discussing in different workshops and so on was a concept that like a working term is transition to education. Like we had an option in SATSI that is still, I think, present, transition to practice. But think about transition to education. That means if you have a research project, you could opt for increasing your budget automatically by a little, by adding a couple of pages, some kind of standardized description. How would you make an effort to move those frontier ideas that you do in your research into education? So that's something that we've been discussing for a few years and might materialize.
So my understanding is a large amount of that $45 million was to CyberCore, though,
correct?
Right, which goes directly to the students to attract them to the discipline, not necessarily in the research of cybersecurity education. So yeah. I don't know what that number is. But personally speaking, it's not the amount of money; it's maybe the duration of time. You know, when we get a 1 or 2 year, or even 3 years, to me that's a short amount of time, especially if you're going to teach a class once a year, like I am with my program. So I would, in the same way that SASE has small, medium, and large for traditional foundational research, I would be in favor of seeing something similar.
Short and long.
Yeah, short and long. Yeah, right. Just duration.
Yeah, I will say that we hosted a cybersecurity education workshop last year. Under the SATC umbrella, and the report from that workshop gave some specific recommendations to NSF on how to structure the educational funding that was given. So, you know, here are the places where we think that there is room for significant impact, where we can really get some economies of scale, and things that we think are really missing in this idea of concept inventories came up, the working on measurable assessments, collaboration across disciplines, those kinds of things. But it's all laid out in that report, which actually was referenced in an eager that came out last fall, looking specifically for innovative, transformative cybersecurity education proposals.
So I'll probably get my union card taken away for saying this, but I have a hard time believing that if somebody had a really good education proposal, there isn't a way of getting it funded. Part of the difficulty is you have to go to the technical programs, in my experience, as somebody who has applied for ED money in addition to like research money, is if you write to education people, you have to speak education speak, and as we just said, the person who left earlier but who started off the questioning, we don't know how to do that. Right? And it doesn't matter how good an idea you have and how good your evaluation is, if you don't know how to speak a certain way, you're not going to get that money. So you have to come to these programs. Now, I imagine the money is there, but the difficulty is, again, there are these programs like Scholarship of Service, which are a wonderful program for certain things, but they're not going to help in the slightest with some of the things we're talking about over here. So these numbers, in some sense, Victor, I would argue, are not even very meaningful, because Scholarship for Service, again, great program, but it's achieving a very specific need that the federal government has that's different from, you know, us doing research in this area over here, right? And so I guess the mechanism you're suggesting is the supplements, and maybe that's one way to go. But I honestly believe that if somebody wrote a really good proposal about this, it wouldn't get fun. I have a hard time believing that.
Right, right, right. Yeah,
it should not be construed as my saying we don't need more money, because I'll get pelted for saying that.
Quite often from the practical level is that if you have a research project and at some point you realize that there's some wonderful educational activity that could be attached to this. And that the typical request is you ask for a supplement that is, you know, within the scope general of the project, but at some, for some additional educational activities.
So, Victor, the downside to that is it doesn't then get the peer review that an actual proposal would have gotten. Right? Right. An actual proposal that's actually trying to make an educational contribution gets evaluated in those terms is looked at in a very different way and evaluated in a very different way.
That is correct.
That's a little bit of a difficulty, right? It's great that the mechanism's there,
right,
but it's not the same as actually, you know.
Right. Yeah. But just to give you some numbers, okay, the last basically thing to finish this because you have two more questions. The numbers are good. Like, for example, our call for EAGERs, we receive 112 responses for a dear colleague letter. So that means there is
this is the one that went out last year.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is the very huge response. We were actually hoping for 50 and we received 112. So in that sense, you know, that is a great interest in the community. Okay, who was first?
Hi, I'm Terry Benzel, University of Southern California Information Sciences Institute. And while it's important that we've spent this time talking a lot about undergraduate education and STEM and how to get people in and, you know, what kinds of capabilities we have, I don't think I've heard quite enough to talk about, you know, educating sophisticated grad students. How do we build the next generation of the researchers? And I think that, you know, let's put aside for a moment the issues of whether or not people are coming into schools knowing enough and have the basic capabilities. Let's take our smart students that we already have and how do we help educate them in cybersecurity and do cybersecurity from a rigorous, scientific basis, you know, to make some advances and perhaps make some impact, in the world. And then, you know, I'm more making a statement than a question, but would like to hear from you on educating sophisticated next generation researchers. And then I'll finish with a little bit of a plug for the role of experimentation in cybersecurity research. And I think that experimental facilities are something that can help us do more rigorous, advanced research, sophisticated facilities. I am not talking about training systems for those next generation of professionals that are going to go out there and operate things. That needs to happen. But I'm talking about sophisticated research kinds of facilities. And plug finish tomorrow afternoon, one of the breakout sessions is on cyber experimentation in the future, aimed at these sophisticated audiences.
Wonderful. And the responses?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. I think if you look at the Talby survey, there was something like 8% of all graduating PhDs were self-identified as being a security PhD. And that if you look at the number of, we have an open position for a security faculty member at Cal Poly, and apparently 25% of the open faculty positions this year are in security. The other 25, another 25% is in big data. And then tails off from there. So there is huge demand. And I don't know why the demand by itself does not draw. Maybe it's just temporal. Maybe it's due to economics. Maybe there's bubbles in the pipeline. To me, it's inherent. I mean, it's such an interesting field, and there's so much meat out there. I don't know why it has this problem.
So I would respond in two ways. One, I think that part of the issue is money, and that those who are graduating are able to go into non-faculty positions and make quite a bit more money. But the other thing that I'll say is that in relation to your question, I have a pilot doctoral program that I'm operating with funding from Victor, where we brought in students who already had cybersecurity practical experience. We're talking people who are working like at the chief technology officer, chief information security officer type level. We're bringing them in and then helping them to get research skills, risk analysis, understanding more of social behavioral, those kinds of things, so that they can then go back out and become consumers, producers of research in the security realm. And so we're running this as a pilot to help Victor to think through some other creative ways to begin to develop that upper level researcher type person that you speak of.
And if I can add just one more thing quickly, I'm currently in the division of graduate education, and one thing that we are working is
there is a lot of initiatives in undergraduate education for several years, like how to, you know, improve STEM. But very little movement was in the at the graduate level. So right now there is, you know, under the White House, essentially an OSTP office, a committee that's working on innovation in graduate education. And you know, the comments that you made is exactly like in the core, looking for alternative experiences, alternative pathways, residency programs, and so on. We started some pilots with National Lab and federal agencies trying to give students different opportunities during their graduate study, some innovation. Okay, back to Alec.
Alec Yasinsack, University of South Alabama. Back in 1980, a young second lieutenant went to school in the United States Marine Corps to learn about computers, and he learned this thing about go-tos considered harmful. I don't know if any of you remember that. And he studied this stuff, and in 6 weeks, he went out into the field, and he came in, and he said, I want to start doing our walkthroughs in our programming organization. And what the senior guys said there was, we don't do that stuff here. I know you learned that stuff in school. It was great stuff in school. We don't do that here. We're trying to influence the security of our country at the beginning end, at the front end. What about all of those middle-level managers that are out there today that didn't get these good curriculum that we're offering today? What's the role of education? Is there a role of education for reaching out to those middle managers that can save those good second lieutenants that we send out there with that good training on go-tos considered harmful?
So I don't know if this is just because of where I sit, but at least in my household, we have two graduate programs in cybersecurity being developed for working managers. So I could have a biased view of the world. But I see that there's a lot more of these opportunities coming up, like professional master's certification kinds of things. The problem is who's going to pay for them, and who's going to pay for them are the people with the money. And perhaps that's, you know, maybe that's a place where the government actually helps for pay for people who have the need but don't have the money, right? So there's clearly a lot of money to be made in master's programs for this sort of thing.
Remember, right? 80% of critical infrastructure is in private hands, not government.
Yeah.
Well, so it has to be a partnership.
Yeah, yeah. So the point is, I think those programs are there. The question is, paying for the programs is a completely separate matter. So the programs are very much coming into existence. I'm sure I suspect if we looked around the room, there's probably a whole bunch of people who are creating these kinds of programs right now.
And I think that we have to differentiate between middle managers who are middle managers in cybersecurity and maybe need professional development, and middle managers who are in finance or every other part of the business who need to understand the nature of this environment and to understand it as a risk challenge, mm-hmm. as opposed mm-hmm. to a technical one.
Exactly.
Because I think if we can frame it the right way, then they'll get it as why it's fundamentally important to the business. And that can come through certificate programs, continuing education, professional development programs in a number of different flavors.
And I guess the point, the latter is the kind I'm talking about, but the point is the market demand is clearly there, right?
So why don't you ask the room, how many places do this? I mean, we don't have a program that has classes at night that second career people could take at my university. You say it's
prevalent. Well, it may not be night. I mean, there's lots of ways of dealing with the fact that people are going to be working full time while doing these programs. Mm-hmm. Right?
Is that in fact what you said? Is that true?
Yeah,
how many people have a program that are for second career people that could do this?
Okay, so three of those hands should go down because I'm already referring to one of those programs. So maybe only about four other hands. Okay.
So again, I just ask, is there not more of a role to push for education for going after that bunch?
Alec, wonderful topic for birds of the feather.
Yeah. Coursera.
You have a group already.
Right. All right. Coursera now has a four-course sequence offered through the Coursera now has a four-course sequence offered through the University of Maryland. And I think if you pay money, you get a piece of paper in return on security.
Okay, Carl?
I want to suggest another answer for Alex's question. I think the difficulty is you can produce students who are trained the way you think they ought to be trained, and the question is how to get industry to adopt those practices. And I'm not sure that providing more education is the most effective way to do that. I think something that's been touched on earlier in the discussion, which is getting a consensus around a core set of principles for building the systems, and then putting that out there as some kind of what I'm calling a building code, that then managers can look at their systems and say, look, we're not building this according to that standard. Then they'll need the people to understand the ways to build those systems. And I think that that may be a more effective way to persuade middle managers to adopt these practices. And I think that is something, it's not just an education question, it's a question for the academic community as a whole to get behind something like that. And to blow my own horn for a minute, I decided I couldn't just talk about this, so a couple of months ago I organized a workshop on developing a building code for software security and medical device software, and I think that's a way to get started.
Thank you, Carl. And I think we have time for one more question.
Okay, well, this is maybe from outside what you've been talking about, but I sit on a board of a company that was recently hacked and the employee information was stolen in spite of a number of steps taken by their security personnel, and they have a big information system staff that was focused on security, and we on the board were assured that everything was okay until this intrusion happened. And then a huge effort was taken to educate employees and, down to the janitorial staff.
I don't know why he's at the bottom.
And I want to give you another piece of sort of broader information coming from a national sample study by the Pew Foundation that we did with them, the Internet Foundation, on the predictors of people taking steps to protect their privacy and security of their systems. And the biggest one of the biggest predictor is that they've had a prior past bad experience on the internet. So this leads me to wonder if we need to somehow purposely hack into every company's system and give them a good scare in order to get them to really pay attention.
Right. I can't be party to that conversation.
Well, Sony is probably, that's what will be remembered as 2015, when cybersecurity became known to everybody. So we are at that stage right now, but guys, you want to comment on this?
I don't know. Am I being a conspiracy theorist when I say that Sony's reaction was more political than it was technical, right? I think the changing the argument to the theft of a movie rather than, maybe millions of dollars of intellectual property or sensitive PII. Everything that I've seen that has been critical of Sony's technical infrastructure still remains valid, right? And now we see sanctions against North Korea, and it's not even clear that North Korea was involved, right? So Sony did a great job. Maybe this is a lesson to be learned, mm-hmm. right? That there are lots of solutions to security that may not be technical as well. Sorry, tinfoil hat off.
Okay, I think probably that's the wrap time, right? Let's thank our panelists.